This represents one of my, going to be handled carefully, collector's items, the works of Josephus, the famous Jewish historian. I want to repeat, I have no sympathy for Jimmy Baker. In his ministry, I was the first to publicly took him off of our network when I was elected pastor. And give me a little better sound in here. Turn it up a little. I publicly removed him from our network. For financial mishandling of funds. It was the very first major conflict I had with the religious establishment. Jim Baker blandly announced to me it would hurt me worse than him. And the religious establishment thought I was so terrible to do such a thing to such a gentle, sweet Christian as Jim Baker. Threw Pat Robinson off Hartford about the same time. Took over a church where all the religious big shots were bleeding it and the congregation was suffering. And got condemned by the religious establishment for telling the truth. But when they imprisoned Jim Baker for 45 years, I was the first public religious voice to say he was a political prisoner. The punishment did not fit the crime. And all you have to do is compare the punishment meted out to the white-collar crooks on Wall Street who made anything Jim Baker did look like kindergarten play or kindergarten play by comparison. I don't have any real speakers in here. I wish somebody would give me some volume in this room because I cannot continue to teach if I have to. Now I'm getting a little bit of a sound in here. That's enough. And I was the first to come forth and speak to the principal, though I didn't like him. I was one of the first, though later religious leaders followed, to speak out when Moon was given the treatment he was given as religious persecution. Like coyotes, they find the cripples and the fringes and go after them. I was the first historic churchman to come to the defense of the Worldwide Church of God when the travesty in California occurred. In spite of warning by friends saying they're a cult and you'll hurt yourself by association. I've lived with a principle articulated in that statement in Germany they came for the communists and I wasn't one of them and I did nothing. They came for the socialists, and I wasn't one of them, and I did nothing. They came for the Jews, and I wasn't one of them, and I did nothing. They came for me, and there was nobody to do anything for me. Fascism in embryo has to be resisted because it's a fast-growing, malignant cancer. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. I find it ironic to read in the LA Times today that the arson expert giving the reports and leading the analysis in Waco has been disclosed to have a former relationship with the ATF as well as his wife. Get a fox to tell you why there's nothing but feathers left in the coop. Now, I'm not defending David Koresh. I am defending the First Amendment. I am defending the right of any citizen in this country to be safe in their homes, and any church to have the right not to be assaulted like we're invading Grenada. And I still say the solution to Waco was to build a 40-foot fence, make sure they got water and power, and leftovers from the closest kitchen of a state prison, a telephone, a few jeeps to go around outside. Lock the fence on the outside. Tell them they hold the key. When they're ready to come out, call us. That would have been the cheapest prison for life that the taxpayers could have paid for. What we had was a macho need and overkill. No one had any right to assume that everyone in that compound was part of a conspiracy to murder federal agents. Now, having done their act, they're trying to suggest that some were shot who wanted to escape. Okay, let's believe that current lie. Then why would not those same ones have faced the possibility of being shot if they'd tried to leave earlier? There was no attempt by the federal government to suggest that maybe there were some in there held against their will, and thus why broad brush it and guarantee that everyone that came out would be charged with conspiracy and face most of their life in prison? We live in a secular world that knows of nothing worth dying for except your country. I'm still reminded of the opening scenes of the movie Godfather, where the little snot girl that was a daughter of a senator was seeking to imitate the son of the Godfather, by saying her father didn't order people to go out and kill people. What about Vietnam? And we're reading today, why is a government employee any less credible when he leaves than while he was inside? Ex-CIA agent who fled to the Philippines from San Francisco, who is threatening to expose the CIA's participation in South American death squads if they seek to prosecute him, and naming where and what is the evidence to support his expose, who were lied to about the Bay of Pigs. Nobody knows the truth about the assassination of Jack Kennedy. Certainly don't know the truth about Martin Luther King. Bobby Kennedy. I give the hippies credit, at least they were the first to recognize the government's tendency to lie. We're no longer secure in the knowledge that those that we pay, who are supposed to be civil servants, who swear to uphold the Constitution, they can no longer be counted on to pursue truth for the good of mankind. And they really do not want any authority higher than themselves, in spite of the fact that they're supposed to be under a constitution that declares there are certain rights higher than man's ability to either grant or take away. And I will not grow tired of repeating, however bad Koresh was, whoever caused the confrontation first and the conflagration last, the U.S. government has no business broadcasting Buddhist chants to a Seventh-day Adventist religious group. We in this country at least are supposed to be safe from the government trumpeting any particular faith. They had no business raising the flag of the ATF over the dead bodies of those cult members, no matter how deeply they feel about the four officers killed. You don't raise a flag of a rival faction as though you've won a victory over a foreign enemy and seized their territory. And this United States, before the ashes of even the dead children have been removed, and sing a hypocritical song that it's the children that concern you most. They're saying, why didn't they send the children out? Well, if they believed that heaven and eternity was a guarantee for the children and their option was a sure and certain expectancy that they would be separated from their kids the minute they left the compound, the parents to be imprisoned, and the kids to become a ward of the state, to be raised in infidelity. If you put yourself inside the minds of those parents, however perverted it may be viewed by the world, from their hearts with their beliefs. They were expressing greater love for their kids than seeing them abandoned into the hands of what they viewed as the devil's instrument for an earthly life. I'm not saying they're right, but I am saying the principle's right. And it is only incapable of being understood by people who do not believe in eternal life at all, or heaven or hell, which includes most Christians. Now, to bring some sanity of history, and the failure to understand history is to doom yourself to forever repeat its mistakes. I intend to stay late tonight and read you from Josephus the story of Masada that only 2,000 years has brought dignity to, as people view it with respect and understanding and a certain amount of awe as they visit that area today. If you want me to do that, get on the telephone. I want to understood. No more calls. That indigenous to all true religion is the spirit of sacrifice, the breath of eternity. And when confronted with a choice that requires God or man, all governments of man feel at the time they're right. And when they intrude into religious areas, they seldom are able to comprehend the willingness of people to die for their faith. It's always been a part of the religious history of man. Every Christmas, the Jews celebrate the Festival of Lights. And oh, how the marshmallows among their leadership love to emphasize the lights part of it, the happiness, the joy. Here's how it started. This is not Masada. I'm going to get up to that. Reading from Josephus, Book 12, Chapter 6. Now at this time there was one whose name was Mattathias, who dwelt at Modin, the son of John, the son of Simeon, son of Asmoneus. You'll also find this story in the apocryphal books of the Maccabees, part, by the way, of the scripture until the British Bible Society and American Bible Society, through pressure from the Puritans, left it out. Well, we suffer a lot of left-outs because of the Puritans. It was in the King James, but I'm reading now from the Jewish historian Josephus, a collector's copy, by the way. A priest of the order of Joarib and a citizen of Jerusalem. He had five sons, John, who was called Gaddis, and Simon, who was called Matthes, and Judas, who was called Maccabeus, and Eleazar, who was called Auran, and Jonathan, who was called Apphus. Now this Mattathias lamented to his children the sad state of their affairs, and the ravage made in the city, and the plundering of the temple, and the calamities the multitude were under. And he told them that it was better for them to die for the laws of their country than to live so ingloriously as they then did. Now, the descendant of the Seleucid portion of the breakup of Alexander's kingdom, at this time ruled by Antiochus, who added the phrase to his name, Epiphanes. I'm talking now, I'm not reading. Josephus. Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means God manifest. He was the first to come along and propose in that area again as the successors of Alexander the Great, who tended to follow the same policy, neutrality in matters of religion. All religions allowed to coexist as long as they recognized it was the government who gave them that power. Well, any religion worthy of the name doesn't feel it gets its right to exist from the government. Now, earthly governments are impressed by size, because of the size and power and influence of the Catholic Church. When the Pope's here, they declare the church parish an embassy. That means legally it has all the rights of a diplomatic embassy while he was in it. In fact, when he entered the doors of that church, having declared it an embassy during his stay here, as an official act of the U.S. government, he was outside U.S. soil. As long as he stayed inside that church building, he was outside the United States and could only be reached by some long, difficult pattern of extradition, as though he were inside Vatican City. Because in absolute contradiction of the Constitution, Jefferson would roll over in his grave. We recognize the Vatican, an absolute religious oligarchy, as a state co-equal with any other state in the world. Fair and equal treatment would have demanded that every church in America become an embassy. Am I recommending that? I don't think it's such a bad idea. But what's good for one is good for another. Jesus didn't have much of a following when he was here. Not near as much as the Pope has now in his name. Waco's compound was a church. Does that mean the Pope could have gone inside the parish, declared an embassy here in Los Angeles, and committed all kinds of atrocities? No. Any more than they can inside the Russian embassy. They can't sit on the roof of the Russian embassy and shoot sniper bullets down the road going in any direction from the embassy. But the way you handle the crime is with kid gloves. You don't treat the Russian embassy or the Catholic parish house when it was made an embassy for the Pope. You don't treat it the same way you treat a known rock house. In some section in a suburb of one of our major cities. A different set of rights invoke. A recognition that, like it or lump it, religion has the power to attract total commitments from people. Some badly focused and some good. Now, the wonderful city of Festival of Lights starts like this. But when those that were appointed by the king were come to Modin, that they might compel the Jews to do what they were commanded and to enjoin those that were there to offer sacrifice as the king had commanded, they desired that Mattathias, a person of the greatest character among them, both on other accounts and particularly on account of such a numerous and so deserving a family of children, would begin the sacrifice because his fellow citizens would follow his example and because such a procedure would make him honored by the king. Well, nobody was asking the Waco crowd to sacrifice. Well, in their view, they were being expected to sacrifice their kids to become wards of the state, which to them was worse than death. I'm not saying they were right. I'm saying the matter could have been handled differently. They were asked to surrender to a government in violation of our highest law of the land, who was pounding their eardrums with Buddhist chants. A government that would play Buddhist chants at them. You ask the parents to turn their kids over to that government and themselves over to that government? Just because somebody wears a badge doesn't mean they deserve respect of proper government agents. The only proper government agent is an agent who acts within his oath to preserve the Constitution. There ain't a 12-year-old kid in America that doesn't know that when the government is playing Buddhist chants, they are seeking to compel a listening of government propagation of a particular religious faith. Oh, they didn't understand the chants. How do you know they didn't? That's irrelevant. And they turned that speaker on with a Buddhist chant, they stepped outside their role proper as upholders of the Constitution. They became outlaws. You're steps away, short steps away, from licking the boot of a Nazi. When because someone wears a badge, you assume they can do no wrong. Intelligent Christians evaluate their preachers by God's word, including this one. When I step outside of God's word, rightly divided, I'm an outlaw. When a government agent steps outside the Constitution, he is a criminal and an outlaw. In this country, both the governor and the governed, the badge keeper and the one on the other side of the badge, are under the highest law of the land. How ironic, in this United States, on the East Coast, we celebrate victory over Nazi Germany. On the West Coast, we celebrate victory of a guilty plea over at least two cops who violated one black man's civil rights. And in middle United States, 80 people die and nobody even wants to talk about government violations of constitutional rights. We're almost afraid to talk about it, lest it appear we're supporting a fanatical cult and want to see kids burn up. Well, those kids died in vain if it doesn't rouse the conscience of this nation. I heard a self-important asteroid orifice of a television interviewer taken up in himself. With a sorry example of a defense for David Koresh, carrying on conversations today. And the interviewer was so proud of himself for pointing out that those kids, 4 years old and under, didn't have a right of choice about their religious beliefs. Therefore, they should have been released. As wards of the state, would they have had a choice? As wards of the state, would they have had a fair chance to consider the beliefs their parents had in Branch Davidianism? Get off your rhetoric. Are the children of the Amish that we make movies about, that have attained the status in these United States of a cultural treasure, are those children raised by the Amish who have won their rights constitutionally to raise their children the way they raise them? Are they having a choice? It goes with the territory. Do children raised by gay parents have the same view of life as a fundamentalist couple in Calvary Chapel? Do Catholic children in a Catholic school have the same spectrum of choice? as children of parents who attend the local Madeline Murray Honorary Society. It goes with the territory, and it comes under the definition of what is supposed to be great of this United States, pluralism. You first-generation children of Chinese parents with the respect for ancestors have the same choices as a child in an orphanage. His mother was killed by a dope-dealing husband who is in prison for life. My plea is for some intelligent sanity in this United States. Some old-fashioned individualism that quits being brainwashed by 110 IQ plastic surgery imitation hypocrites called media experts, talking heads who have never read anything more profound than one-inch letters on an idiot card. But Mattathias said, he would not do it. And that if all the other nations would obey the commands of Antiochus, either out of fear or to please him, yet would not he or nor his sons leave the religious worship of their country. But as soon as he had ended his speech, there came one of the Jews into the midst of them and sacrificed as Antiochus had commanded. There's always somebody who will leave any religious group and turn on them for whatever reason. At which Mattathias had great indignation and ran upon him violently with his sons who had swords with them and slew both the man himself that sacrificed and Apelles, the king's general, who compelled them to sacrifice with a few of his soldiers, government officers. He also overthrew the idol altar and cried out, "If," said he, "anyone be zealous for the laws of his country and for the worship of God, let him follow me." And when he had said this, he made haste into the desert with his sons and left all his substance in the village. Many others did the same also and fled with their children and wives into the desert and dwelt in caves. But when the king's generals heard this, they took all the forces they then had in the citadel of Jerusalem and pursued the Jews into the desert. And when they had overtaken them, they in the first place endeavored to persuade them to repent. At least they didn't play Buddha's chants. And to choose what was most for their advantage and not put them to the necessity of using them according to the law of war. But when they would not comply with their persuasions, but continued to be of a different mind, they fought against them on the Sabbath day. That's typical government logic. We can't persuade them. They have a faith. We know they won't be ready to fight on the Sabbath. So when we can't persuade them, let's attack them on their religious day so we got the greatest advantage. Don't take any more calls. Don't make any more. I'm reading about how the Feast of Hanukkah started. What Hanukkah really celebrates. When the government of Antiochus Epiphanes could not persuade the Jews into making sacrifice to Antiochus, the government. You say, well, nobody's making sacrifices. We're talking matters of degree. When you're asked to compromise your faith in God, in favor of government, you stand as Peter did in the Pentecost days of the foundation of the church called Christian, when he answered the question, shall I obey man or God? You have the decision of Polycarp as they bound him, the church father, to the stake and forced the choice of his Christ or Rome. For 70 years I've served my Lord, he said, and he hath done me no harm. How then can I blaspheme of the name of him who loved me? And they burned him at the stake. Foundations of our Protestant faith flow out of martyrs like Latimer, who looked across the fire to his fellow Christian, being burned at the stake for no just cause, saying, be of good cheer, Mr. Ridley, for we shall this day build such a flame in England as shall never, or kindle such a flame in England as shall never go out. Having fled with their children and wives into the desert and dwelt in caves, government wasn't willing to just leave them alone. Build a fence around the caves. They had to humiliate them. Became a macho test of power. So they then picked the day, their Sabbath. And they fought against them on the Sabbath day, and they burnt them as they were in the caves without resistance and without so much as stopping up the entrances of the caves. And they avoided to defend themselves on that day because they were not willing to break in upon the honor they owed the Sabbath in such distresses, for our law requires that we rest upon that day. I wonder how the media would debate that today. These children didn't have a choice about Sabbath. The caves weren't even boarded up. And they burned to death in those caves rather than violate their religious conviction about the Sabbath. There were about 1,000 with their wives and children who were smothered and died in these caves. But many of those that escaped joined themselves to Mattathias and appointed him to be their ruler, who taught them to fight even on the Sabbath day. And told them that unless they would do so, they would become their own enemies by observing the law so rigorously, while their adversaries would still assault them on this day, and they would not then defend themselves, and that nothing could then hinder, but they must all perish without fighting. So Mattathias got a great army about him and overthrew their idol altars and slew those that broke the laws, even all that he could get under his power, for many of them were dispersed among the nations round about them for fear of him. He also commanded that those boys which were not yet circumcised should be circumcised now. Child abuse. Can't think of any abuse worse than cutting the end of your private parts off. You better believe those kids thought they were being abused. Wasn't a voluntary act. And he drove those away that were appointed to hinder such their circumcision. And when he had ruled 1 year and was fallen into a distemper, he called for his sons and set them round about him and said, O my sons, I am going the way of all the earth, and I recommend to you my resolution, and beseech you not to be negligent in keeping it, but to be mindful of the desires of him who begat you, and brought you up, and to preserve the customs of your country, and to recover your ancient form of government, which is in danger of being overturned, and not be carried away with those that either by their own inclination or out of necessity betray it, but to become such sons as are worthy of me, to be above all force and necessity, and so to dispose your souls as to be ready, when it shall be necessary, to die for your laws, as sensible of this by just reasoning, that if God see that you are so disposed, He will not overlook you, but will have a great value for your virtue, and will restore to you again what you have lost, and will return to you that freedom in which you shall live quietly and enjoy your own customs. Your bodies are mortal and subject to fate, but they receive a sort of immortality by the remembrance of what actions they have done. And I would have you so in love with this immortality that you may pursue after glory, and that when you have undergone the greatest difficulties, you may not scruple for such things to lose your lives. I exhort you especially to agree with one another, and in what excellency any one of you exceeds another, to yield to him so far, and by that means to reap the advantage of everyone's own virtues. When Mattathias had thus discoursed to his sons and prayed to God to be their assistant and to recover to the people their former constitution, he died a little afterward and was buried at Modine, all the people making great lamentation for him. Whereupon his son Judas took upon him the administration of public affairs in the 146th year, and thus by the ready assistance of his brethren and of others, Judas cast their enemies out of the country and put those of their own country to death who had transgressed its laws and purified the land of all the pollution that were in it. Defeating the forces of the Greeks under Antiochus, the Maccabean rebellion, restored the Jewish state, restored the temple, lit the menorah again after many years, cleansed out the heathen practices, and set up the Jewish state in readiness that was there for the coming of the Messiah. And it is that restoration of the temple and the lighting of the candles that is emphasized in modern society at the Feast of Hanukkah. And they play down the blood and guts of the fight for religious freedom that Hanukkah really celebrates. Reading from Josephus. When Bassus was dead in Judea, Flavius Silva succeeded him as procurator there, who, when he saw that all the rest of the country was subdued in this war and that there was but only one stronghold that was still in rebellion, which proves we're alive, he got all his army together that lay in different places and made an expedition against it. This fortress was called Masada. It was one Eleazar, a potent man, and the commander of these Sicarii that had seized upon it. He was a descendant from that Judas who had persuaded abundance of the Jews, as we have formerly related, not to submit to the taxation when Cyrenius was sent into Judea to make one. For then it was that the Sicarii got together against those that were willing to submit to the Romans, and treated them in all respects as if they had been their enemies, both by plundering them of what they had, by driving away their cattle, and by setting fire to their houses. For they said that they differed not at all from foreigners by betraying in so cowardly a manner that freedom which the Jews thought worthy to be contended for to the utmost, and by owning that they preferred slavery under the Roman before such contention. Now that made them outlaws. Now this was in reality no better than a pretense and a cloak for the barbarity which was made use of by them, and to color over their own avarice, which they afterward made evident by their own actions. For those that were partners with them in their rebellion joined also with them in the war against the Romans. And let me keep skipping along because of the time to the next paragraph of this chapter 8 of book 7. For now it was that the Roman general came and led his army against Eleazar and those Sicarii who held the fortress Masada together with him. And for the whole country adjoining, he presently gained it, put garrisons into the most proper places of it. He also built a wall quite round the entire fortress that none of the besieged might easily escape. He also set his men to guard the several parts of it. He also pitched his camp in such an agreeable place as he had chosen for the siege, at which place the rock belonging to the fortress did make the nearest approach to the neighboring mountain, which yet was a place of difficulty for getting plenty of provision. I visited Masada, as some of you have, the head of the Dead Sea, a towering fortress on the top of a hill. And having besieged this city, built a wall around it till no one could get out. Starving them, depriving them of water. However, neither did Eleazar once think of flying away, nor would he permit anyone else to do so. But when he saw their wall burned down, as the Roman soldiers continued to besiege them, by the fire, and could devise no other way of escaping, or room for their further courage, and setting before their eyes what the Romans would do to them, their children, and their wives, if they got them into their power, he consulted about having them all slain. Now, as he judged this to be the best thing they could do in their present circumstances, he gathered the most courageous of his companions together and encouraged them to take that course by a speech, which he made to them in the manner following. Since we long ago, my generous friends, resolved never to be servants to the Romans, nor to any other than to God himself, who alone is the true and just Lord of mankind, the time has now come that obliges us to make that resolution true in practice. And let us not at this time bring a reproach upon ourselves for self-contradiction. While we formerly would not undergo slavery, though it were then without danger, but must now, together with slavery, choose such punishments also as are intolerable. We were the very first that revolted from them, the Romans, that is. And we are the last that fight against them. And I cannot but esteem it as a favor that God hath granted us, that it is still in our power to die bravely and in a state of freedom, which hath not been the case of others who were conquered unexpectedly. It is very plain that we shall be taken within a day's time, but it is still an eligible thing to die after a glorious manner together with our dearest friends. This is what our enemies themselves cannot by any means hinder, although they be very desirous to take us alive, nor can we propose to ourselves any more to fight them and beat them. To be sure, we weakly hope to have preserved ourselves, and ourselves alone still in a state of freedom. Wherefore, consider how God hath convinced us that our hopes were in vain, by bringing such distress upon us in the desperate state we are now in, and which is beyond all our expectations. Let our wives die before they are abused, and our children before they have tasted slavery. And after we have slain them, our children, let us bestow that glorious benefit upon one another mutually, and preserve ourselves in freedom as an excellent funeral monument for us. Some were in doubt whether or not they should do this. He continued a speech that goes through two pages, in which he points out that even the Indians have more belief and hope for eternity than for the things of this life, and surely they could not do less. Into chapter 9, he continued his exhortations that this was the only way to go. Now, as Eliezer was proceeding on in this exhortation, they all cut him off short and made haste to do the work as full of an unconquerable ardor of mind and moved with a demoniacal fury. So they went their ways as one still endeavoring to be before another and as thinking that their eagerness would be a demonstration of their courage and good conduct if they could avoid appearing in the last class. So great was the zeal they were in to slay their wives and children and themselves also. When they came to the work itself, did their courage fail them as one might imagine it would have done? They then held fast the same resolution without wavering, which they had upon hearing of Eliezer's speech. Yet every one of them still retained the natural passion of love to themselves and their families, because the reasoning they went upon appeared to them to be very just, appeared to them, even with regard to those that were dearest to them. For the husbands tenderly embraced their wives and took their children into their arms and gave the longest parting kisses to them with tears in their eyes. Yet at the same time did they complete what they had resolved on as if they had been executed by the hands of strangers. And they had nothing else for their comfort but the necessity they were in of doing this execution to avoid that prospect they had of the miseries they were to suffer from their enemies. So these people died, that they would leave not so much as one soul among them all alive to be subject unto the Romans. I'm skipping along. How did we know this story? Yet was there an ancient woman and another who was of kin to Eliezer and superior to most women of prudence and learning, with five children who had concealed themselves in caverns underground and had carried water thither for their drink and were hidden there when the rest were intent upon the slaughter of one another. Those others were 960 in number, the women and children being withal included in that computation. The calamitous slaughter was made on the 15th day of the month Nisan. Now, for the Romans, they expected that they should be fought in the morning. When they arrived, they faced nothing but dead bodies. They gave a shout to try to see if there was anyone hearing within. The women heard this noise and came out of their underground cavern and informed the Romans what had been done as it was done. And the second of them clearly described all, both what was said and what was done, and the manner of it.